The Babylon Podcast was our last best hope for B5 fans. A self-contained show, 1 hour long, located on an RSS feed. A place for interviews and episode discussions for a whole bunch of humans and aliens. A shining beacon in cyberspace, all alone on the web. It was the dawn of the third age of podcasting, the year the Lost Tales came upon us all. This is the podcast about the story of the last of the Babylon stations. The year is 2007. The name of the show is The Babylon Podcast.
And welcome back to The Babylon Podcast. I'm Christina Carr.
And I'm still ye old Babcast editor, Brad Boyer.
Summer, Tim, and Jeffrey had so much fun with the last interview and deep geeking that Brad had to split the show into two parts.
Last episode, you got the great interview with Keegan McIntosh, as well as another installment of Three-Edged Sword, and tonight, as promised, is finally the long-awaited deep geeking on this second story in Babylon 5 The Lost Tales, Over There.
And we also have for you another chapter of Three-Edged Sword Saga.
So, enough of our geeky chatter, let's get on with the show.
This is Captain Yarsto, EAS Netherlands.
Area Planum, Command Post, reporting.
This is NBS-1, Squad Leader Tijan.
We are not hostile. I repeat, we are not hostile.
The Corps is mother, the Corps is father.
I will need to protect the interests of our people.
Rebels, we fought here at Orion 7 in the name of freedom.
Three-Edged Sword, Episode 14. Small Problems.
As you might expect, Commander, our access to the Earth Force datanet was cut off after the secession. But we managed to get local copies of most of the database before it was. What we don't have, we can get from other sources if we really have to. And while what we have only has limited data from the Centauri, their policy on Narn fugitives, and the Narn military in particular, is not what you'd call a secret.
Of course.
We managed to find your name eventually, and it has quite a price tag attached to it. Preferably alive, but that's negotiable with the Centauri.
Tempted, Captain?
If I were, you'd be dead or in chains, and your fighters would be floating wreckage. With your rank and the advanced fighters, I can see why you'd be high on the Centauri wish list. But the difficulty in getting this information indicates that Centauri intelligence took more than usual pains to try to keep the knowledge of your liberty to themselves.
Ah, you want to know why the Centauri are so interested. Why would they place a humble squad leader at such great value?
If we are allies, we should know what we're getting into. Wouldn't you agree, Commander?
A fair point. Let me tell you one true thing about the Centauri, Captain. Their hatred of the Narn is hardly a secret. They trumpet their conquest to the galaxy on every possible occasion. They celebrate their butchery. But the details, Captain, the details they keep to themselves. The Centauri have a saying, large problems come from small problems. A truism of the universe, they would say. A truism they happily apply to the Narn at this very moment. When the occupation came upon us again, it was first a matter of population control. Bands of Centauri sent from village to village, weeding out the violent resistance, breaking the backs of the survivors. But that was not enough. Violence, they say, runs deep, fueled by anger and pride. So they search for those qualities as well, and purge them. For the good of the Narn, they say. And sooner or later, when the able-bodied men and women are imprisoned or slaughtered, they will stop and consider. Large problems come from small problems. And they will look into the eyes of every Narn child and see, reflected there, the anger and bitterness of loss and subjugation. They will see hundreds, thousands, even millions of small problems. They did it to us once, Captain. They were driven off our world before they could exact their final solution to non-aggression. I should know. I was simply a small problem when I killed my first Centauri.
So you're saying that's what's driving them? The need to correct what they see as a mistake?
No. Though that would be enough, that is not the only reason.
Then why?
Because I know the secret of their success, Captain. Because they know what I know, and what I intend to do about it.
Personal log, Sirius Planum Command Post. It's official now. The Board of Inquiry has been convened. Investigators have been dispatched to Sirius Planum, as well as out to the Vasset. They've started at the bottom of the chain of command, no doubt hoping they can trip up an underling. Being a junior officer, my classmate has already been questioned. Communications are supposed to be restricted during the investigation, but there's always essential traffic to piggyback on. She only managed a short, coded message, but said they are focusing on the Narn involvement. No surprise there. I just hope the Clark Loyalists are more concerned with us jeopardizing the Centauri Alliance. They tend to obsess on inside-the-dome political minutiae. It can blind them to our subtler means of persuasion. It's too bad the Netherlands isn't debris right now. What happened in hyperspace would stay in hyperspace. We knew victory would forgive us our trespasses. Defeat just brings opportunities to expose them. Close personal log. Open comlink.
Agent 6, please report to briefing room number 2 immediately.
And exactly how do you plan to get us to this waste zone of yours?
We'll be going by a Nar-class transport. Here are the reports on the area.
How do you plan to get a ship into this area? The particle and radiation readings won't let this ship jump anywhere near the battle zone.
True, and that's probably why the wreckage is still intact and not scavenged. The freighter will jump in and drop us off at the closest possible point in 2 Star Furies. They will be able to navigate through the debris fields easier than the transport.
You must be insane. You want us to jump near the site, then fly 2 Star Furies for several hours through an area spiked with radiation and more debris than an asteroid field? Then we must locate and retrieve the replacement targeting computers, avoid the debris, as well as the radiation, and fly for another 6 hours to get out?
The Furies will have extra shielding on their control systems to compensate for the radiation. My captain and your squad leader believe it is possible. The med staff feels our spacesuits will handle the radiation. And as you said earlier, Homeworld isn't answering your part requests.
This seems like a foolhardy attempt.
It's not the easiest supply run, but if you want to keep your ships in the fight, you need to see this mission as a necessity and not optional. This is the best we can come up with. If you've got a better idea, Lieutenant, let's hear it.
You may be right, but your plan won't work. According to your scans, maneuvering through this area will be difficult. Even more so if we have to coordinate 2 ships. It will be easier if we travel together. I assume you have access to a Badger-class Star Fury.
We don't have any based on the Netherlands, but I should be able to get one of the orbital platforms to loan us one.
How are we to signal the transport for pickup after we've completed our objective?
It won't be possible. Even if we could punch a signal through the radiation, Clark's forces are constantly monitoring comm traffic. The transport will pick us up in 18 hours after drop-off. That gives us 12 hours travel time and 6 hours of recovery operations.
We should be able to accomplish this mission easily in that amount of time. Acquiring additional parts should also be no problem.
Lieutenant Commander Hakes, contact Flight Command.
That's the Coventry. Your squad leader had all your equipment you specified transferred over to it.
We will see. If we are going to succeed in this effort, I will need to bring some additional equipment.
I'm sure we have whatever you need here on the Netherlands. Let's get our equipment together, checked out, and loaded for transport.
Three-Edged Sword is brought to you by Voices of Babylon.
Hi, I'm Brian Richardson, host of What the Cast, the podcast that has a little something for everyone. We talk about current events.
I'm in the opinion that Wikipedia should be a new wonder, the modern great library of Alexandria.
It's like the Library of Alexandria written on Etch-a-Sketches. People keep coming by and shaking them every once in a while.
Movies.
Well, what's your biggest problem with the movie?
Michael Bay!
Okay. No.
The Island!
Hot robot-on-robot action.
Science fiction.
See, actually, the first 30 minutes of that film really were a good story about a boy and his secretly transforming car.
So it's like Harlan Ellison's A Boy and His Dog, just without the dog
exactly.
And Harlan Ellison. And,
every once in a while, math.
Ask me how I rated the movie on a scale from 1 to 5. I said a 5. On a scale from 1 to 10, what would you rate it? I'd say about an 8.
So you're not very good at this whole division and fraction thing.
Someone went to public schools!
So join myself, Crispy, Steven, and Patrick for What the Cast. Available at whatthecast.com.
Digging down to the obscurest facts in fandom, this is Deep Geeking.
I love interviews like that.
That was a lot of fun. Keegan is a great addition to the Babylon 5 community, and his character is a fine addition to the universe as well.
Yes, and it's so much fun to find out that he's a fan, B, a yeah. sci-fi fan, and C, he listened to the show. Holy crap.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know. Isn't that something?
Oh, that's awesome. That's awesome. So, appropriately enough, we are finally going to Deep Geek on the Lost Tales episode Over There.
Over There, yes, in which President Sheridan, on his way to Babylon 5, has a mysterious visitor with an important and perhaps deadly message.
You were not talking about the ISN reporter, right?
No, we're not. But this episode, the more I watch it, the more I'll admit, I am in love with this episode. It's a great standalone. It ties in very nicely with what we know of the characters. You know, it helps that Bruce Boxleitner looks like he has never stopped playing John J. Sheridan. You know, even that opening scene where he's standing on the balcony on Minbar and watching the flyer coming for a landing, and you know, Mr. President, your shuttle's ready. You know, just his body language tells you that he's back in the saddle again,
mm-hmm.
and you know, we're in for a fun ride.
Yeah, just seeing him standing there, staring out at the horizon of Minbar, and he's just enjoying the morning, waiting for his ride.
Yeah.
And it seems like no time has passed since we last saw them. Everything is just a little bit sharper, a little bit cleaner, like you'd expect in, mm-hmm. you know, 10 years of growth in a community, in a civilization. And it's just, it felt, literally watching this episode felt like coming home.
Right. And then his, you know, the voiceover, it's been 10 years, you know,
mm-hmm.
since everything changed. It's like, wow. it was magical. You know, it's, you know, it's there in his voice. And, here's it, at least on the Valen class cruiser, the lack of budget works in very nicely with the Minbari decor, which is two chairs and a black sound stage.
Right.
You know, the one-liner is fantastic. The ISN reporter wants to speak to you. Tell her I'm dead and throw her down the stairs. Perfect. It was spot on.
That was
because we know Sheridan's history with reporters.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, has not been pretty.
No.
No. Exactly. And it shows up, and that's a great line where the reporter comes on and she says, "You don't like reporters." And he goes, "Sure I do, when they're properly cooked."
Yeah. I thought that was... And then how he just, like, segues into the, you know, all the Pac Mara jokes and like that, properly cooked. And I just, that whole scene worked for me. It just, you know, you get the, he's telling his story, and she's like, but you didn't answer my question. And she, he looks at her and goes, okay, here we go. And then he just like, yeah, it's not that I don't like giving interviews. It's like you don't come back after you've done this ride through quantum space.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, it's interesting. That scene, I think, it gives you an insight into the complexity of Sheridan's character. He, you know, at first when he welcomes her in, it is sort of the head of state. You know, he gives the pat answer. And, you know, she gives the little thing about, you know, returning to Babylon 5. It's the demarcation point between soldier and statesman. It's a place of beginnings. Or, you know, he says it's a place of beginnings. She says, and endings, and you know right there where he goes with it in his head. It all shifts right there. You know, he knows. I mean, more so than anybody else. You know, it's one thing to say we know how finite life is and you value every day. But when you're a person like John Sheridan who knows I've got X number of years, period, the end, because the oldest being in the universe told me this, you're acutely aware of that. So, you know, when she says end of endings, you know, he's right there knowing that his time is running out. And that's when he gets, you know, stands up. This might not be a good time, you know, gets all really gruff and postures. But even with that, he allows himself to open up. Again, come back to her, you know? What is it like to come back to Babylon 5? And he's like, it feels good, you know? And that's just the warmth and honesty that's there in the character. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's just, I don't know. It was just funny to see that, how easily it was to slip back into that combination of just seriousness and humor.
Yeah.
And just a little bit of, you know, business. All rolling on, just like, we're doing this.
Carol Rothery does a great job as a reporter of holding her own.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she recognizes that it's going to be a tough interview. You know, as she tells him, you know, you only give two interviews a year, Mr. President. I'm not letting you off the hook that easily.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and, you know, so he gives it. So I wasn't aware that the interview had started. And her expression is like, you know.
And I will admit the little trick of where's the camera? It's right here.
Yeah, with the one finger pointing. It's right here.
It's right here. My director said it would guarantee to get everyone's attention.
Yeah, they'll look at the camera a lot. And then the little smile she gives them right after that, you know. Yeah. And then for all that, the tables get turned, you know, Sheridan has the last laugh.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay, ready, we're going to quantum space. And, you know, he's just right there.
Yeah. Said,
quantum space? And I love the effect because you start getting the audio going out of sync just a bit before you get all the visual effects. So it's like you really get the sense of some titanic cosmic power about to be unleashed. You know, this is something completely new and different, and, you know, it's disorienting. And, of course, Sheridan's reveling in the whole thing because he knows exactly what's coming up now. Oh, yeah, first time through, people get sick, fouling themselves in the most horrible way.
Mm-hmm. I mean, and you see her start to get sick.
Yeah.
And then she's like, he's like, oh, I hope that wasn't a new dress.
Yes, right, right.
And that's all you need to know. But there was one small little tidbit in that exchange when he was describing quantum space that intrigued me because I hadn't noticed it in the timeline. He mentioned that they got the technology when they went to the Vorlon homeworld.
No. He doesn't say going to the Vorlon homeworld. It's technology they got that the Vorlons left behind.
Right.
Oh.
That, I mean,
distinction.
You want to infer that they went to the Vorlon homeworld, but it's not explicitly stated.
Right.
Oh, see, I jumped on that and go, when did they go to the Vorlon homeworld?
And maybe they did. Maybe that's another lost tale out there floating around. But I think given what Keegan had mentioned and given what Peter had implied in his interview, I think it would be presumptuous to say, oh, yeah, maybe they've gone blah, 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 or they haven't. You know, that might be in and of itself.
Mm-hmm.
A particular, now,
yeah,
you know,
I guess.
Because one of the things that you get to next is when Sheridan is asleep and has his dream encounter with Galen. You know, the thing he says to it, just when I think my life is going good for a change, you guys come along and screw it up. So that implies, I mean, this is definitely, I think you can imply that things have been tumultuous and maybe finally things are settling down. Whatever that might have been going on in the previous 10 years, I mean, sure, there's, you know, dealing with the Drac plague, that eats up,
mm-hmm.
what, you know, three or four of those years. But
well, I think it would have been the Drac plague and a telepath war, I believe.
Right, you're right. Yep, that would have all been in there. So, and trying to ride herd on all of that. So, yeah, that's you know, that's the next point. The segue is fantastic. It's
mm-hmm.
just Sheridan in bed, and all of a sudden, looking over this devastated cityscape, and I love the shot. It's the tight close up of just his eyes, and then Galen steps from behind him.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
You know. Look familiar?
Now they were saying that.
You know,
was,
I mean, just you know, nothing good is going to come out of this.
Right, right.
They were saying that was New York, right?
Yes.
Did
yes.
anybody else catch that? The building, one of the most prominent blue buildings in the front there, with the kind of hole in the top, is a building that's currently being built in China.
Really?
No.
Yeah.
Did not know that.
Yeah, I looked at that and went, "Hey, that doesn't belong in New York."
Maybe they built a twin.
This is the New York of 2270-something. So.
Yeah, so maybe it's intercontinental New York.
Maybe somebody bought it and moved it. Who knows?
Could be.
Yeah, they do that nowadays, don't they? No, I think they would, if it was a successful building and it was owned by a megacorp, I could see that wanting them to put their stamp in every
sure.
major city.
Yeah,
you know?
Possibly.
I mean, you know, what's the big one in Chicago is the Sears Tower, the one with the...
Yeah, mm-hmm.
The one with the diamond
Sears
on
Tower.
It? Yeah.
Yeah.
Is that?
Yeah. I think it's
Sears. No,
yeah,
Sears. No, that's not the Sears Tower.
Sears Tower is the chrome
one
in
about.
New York. Yeah, I know the one you're talking about.
Anyway,
now.
Yeah. It just,
well,
yeah,
here's just an interesting bit of trivia. I know that the CG artist that worked on that sequence, that shot is actually initially comes from a photo he took. He said he was in New York for a convention or a business or a trip or something. I forgot exactly what, but he was looking out his balcony of his hotel over Central Park, and he shot a number of photographs, and he used those as reference for this.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And you can actually still see a part of the park in there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
In that shot.
Right.
I thought that was kind of cool.
Right. Right.
But yeah, just, you know, having Galen said, does it look familiar? Oh, wait, let's try this. And he goes back
yeah, right.
in the... Have all the traffic, and you still got crazy cab drivers. And
yep. And I love that. Up yours. And,
yeah.
And Galen's little half smile until Sheridan whips around and gives him this, you know, this evil glare. But that's when Galen says, you know, this is what was and what is. And will be up to this point, and 1,000 warships are gathering overhead. Now, here's the other thing he said that's interesting. They are warping into space above us.
I didn't catch that.
Yeah. He says you can hear them. He says they are coming into space. They're warping into space above us right now and preparing
right.
to fire, and no one will let in. Boom.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay.
And I love the beams coming down. I mean, that was just that you got the sense of titanic force. And I know we've talked about this. Other people have talked about the hyperbola that Galen employs, and we've discussed it with, you know, previous voicemails on other shows. I still maintain that is Galen selling Sheridan on the immediacy of the situation, the
right.
extremity of the situation.
The necessity of what he's asking him to do.
Mm-hmm.
Right, right. right. And then, you know, as the beam approaches Sheridan and he finally throws his hands up to shield his eyes, and it's back to the featureless space, if you will. Galen says to him, "This is not a dream."
He says, "I know, I know."
Right. I've encountered enough technomages to know the difference between magic real and dream real and real real.
Yeah.
And as he says it, and you know, I'm sick and tired of you people climbing in my head, and showing me this kind of crap.
Yep. I like and the explanation is always the same. You are a nexus. The yeah. world turns the way you turn, as Justin put it in season 3.
Right. Right. Well, and he's, you know, as Galen says, you know, you, why, you know, do we come to you? Because you believe. You know, you don't doubt what we show you. But again, he also knows enough to know when it's trickery or apparently it's trickery or not. You know, and that is as an important a thing as that. You know, and then I loved a little bit after that, after Sheridan dresses him down. It's like, why, you know, why don't you people have hobbies? Like, well, that's hardly a warm welcome. You know, I expected a hello, old friend, or a kiss on the cheek in a manly sort of fashion.
The level of snark and humor there is just awesome.
Oh, yeah.
Because
yeah.
I would like to see where else they had an adventure together or had to work together, because we know it started with a call to arms.
Mm-hmm.
But right. there had to have been more in there for Sheridan to get that familiar
exactly.
frustration. He was like, oh, you again? Geez.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I would not be surprised. And you know, as Peter mentioned in his interview, you know, there's more there than we know. And JMS, regarding to the veracity of the vision that Galen shows, you know, oh, how can a technomage know the future? JMS has pointed out that time travel is a form of technology.
Right.
Mm.
So, so the Nexus has moved through, and I love the, you know, it's like, well, you know, the Christmas Carol thing. Is this what will be or what might be? You know, can this be stopped? Oh, I came all this way just to see the light in your eyes in the face of total planetary Armageddon. Yes, it can be stopped. And what I love that Sheridan is blind, too. It's like, you know, there's a hope, but a slim one at best. Yeah, well, an ordinary hope when it wasn't on a diet.
Yeah, that's a good line.
Yeah. Classic line. And so what do I have to do? Oh, President Sheridan, I thought it was imminently obvious. All you have to do is kill Prince Vendari. And then he wakes up.
Yeah.
You know, there's no see you later, we'll talk more about this. It's just like, you know, drop the bombshell on him.
I don't know. It's just, so, I don't know if the suddenness of the way Galen delivered that leads Sheridan to reevaluate his options later, but to show him all that, to give him the history of what Prince Vendari will do when he becomes emperor and after he becomes emperor, and says, well, duh, kill him.
Right.
Yeah, right. Well, you know, it maybe this is starting to jump ahead a bit, but it could be the Zen master Cohen teaching thing. You're basically applying a massive amount of pressure on the student's brain to get him to break free of his conventional thinking, to
right.
think outside the box, to use the cliche. Because that's what happens, you know. Galen says there are ways to prevent this. It's like, okay, what do I have to do? Well, kill him. Ah. And that's where the dilemma comes in, and I loved it, because the next scene is where Sheridan meets Vendari. And now we have no clue who Vendari is. And let's face it, we're thinking Prince Vendari, okay, might be a young guy, may not be. You know, we've seen the Centauri royal court. They tend to either be, you know, scheming Machiavellian murderers or, you know, bumbling idiots.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
And Sheridan comes around the corner, and there is this strikingly handsome young man standing there. And you can just see it from that one moment. It's like you can see it in Sheridan's face. I got to kill him.
Yeah, I got to kill this.
Right, like, exactly.
He's just a kid.
Yeah. Right, but that, and then that's that next scene is just really classic, mm-hmm. because Ventari comes in and he basically says, you know, well, it's an honor. And you know, the first thing out of his mouth is, this one of the new Valen-class cruisers? I mean, he is a kid. He's, you know, mm-hmm. the kid who's keeping track of spaceships. And, you know, you can see Sheridan, with a visible effort, reaches out, touches him, starts talking to him. And then Ventari keeps gushing on about spaceships. Oh, I love spaceships. I learn all about them, especially the Star Fury. So simple, so elegant, so deadly. And then, once again, there's that look in Sheridan's eyes. Like, okay. Maybe Galen was right. And the whole scene goes back and forth like that, but it's very subtle.
Well, and there's this almost, God, the only way to really describe it is kind of this paranoid, psychopathic innocence about Ventari.
Yeah, right. No, that's a great way to put it. That's exactly it. You know, there's an exuberance for life, but he also recognizes, you know, well, this is the nature of the royal court.
Right.
You know, they sent me, you know, why didn't you, you know, Sharon asked him, why didn't you take a Centauri transport? It's like, well, you know, Emperor Malari is worried that people might kill me. And then Sheridan, again, the compassionate part of him, despite all that, it's like, well, who would want to kill this kid? Well, numbers 3, 4, you know, 4, 5, 6, 7, and 8, I imagine.
Right.
And, you know, he just rolls it off as it's something, you know, it's like something he's lived with the day he was born.
Kind of like, don't you know that, idiot, you know?
Yeah, right.
Yeah, it's just amazing how he was able to portray, you know, you get the sense of youth, you get the sense of innocence, but you can also see he's a little guarded from growing up in the royal court.
Right.
And then you get the bombshell, he's Cartesia's son? Whoa!
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So he's got that extra baggage from people who loved Cartesia and people who hated Cartesia, you know, literally projecting whatever they felt towards his father at him.
Yeah.
And you've got the rumors. You know, he said, you got rumors that Veer killed Cartesia, but no proof.
I love that little bit. It's like, mm-hmm. oh, the only person I don't have to worry about is that idiot Veer Kato. And of course, we know Veer. And Sheridan said, no, I've known Veer for a long time. He's a good man. And Ventari he murdered my father.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like, you know, if I was Cartesia's son, I'd have the same exact attitude.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And so it's just this big ball of yarn is just, you know, raveled up in that one scene. You know, you can see where Ventari could, you know, and you know, with the, like, the paranoia that you talk about, Tim, there's also that bit where he tells Sheridan, I've never really known real kindness, and it's good to know that I don't have to sleep with a knife under my pillow tonight. Thank you.
Right.
You know, and it's just that heartfelt simplicity.
Sheridan
at that point, what is he going to do?
Yeah, you see this, like, sense of relief in his eyes, and then you see Sheridan going, well, now I feel like a heel.
Right.
Right.
You know, I almost detected almost like a sense of wonder, like when you take your kids for the first time to go up and see the snow.
Yes.
You know, it's like, I couldn't imagine that this is ever, you know, even possible, but now I don't have to sleep with a knife.
Right. Right, yeah. Exactly. And I love the little scene, too. That's great. Where, you know, Emperor Malari said that he would trust you with his life. And then he said, no, I would trust him with my life because he was busy next week.
And it's like an inside joke, because, like, you realize that Sheridan knows Londo's humor, and that just strikes him as funny. Mm-hmm. And you see Ventari looking at him like, what?
Yeah, what's so funny?
Right, yeah. Right. This isn't funny. It's like, you know, a lot of people, you know, my father made a lot of enemies, and I've been, you know, that's exactly where he is at that point,
mm-hmm.
you know. So that was great. Sheridan's response, you know, he always did have a sense of humor. So then there's the scene where we're back in the little viewing room, and Sheridan talks with Lockley as they're approaching the station, and she tells him that, you know, ISN wants him to ride in the Star Fury, the conquering hero returning on the stallion that he won the Shadow War in, and all the rest. And, you know, of course, she tells him that, you know, the power of symbolism, and he does.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it, you know, that's even played out in Sleeping in Light. But at that point, you know, after they say their goodbyes, there's Galen again in the chair. So, oh, funny how things work out. Now what do you want? And I love the scene, the shot where it's just Galen rotating in the chair from overhead, bathed in light, saying, you know, well, my associates on the station will rig your Star Fury so that when you reach a certain speed, the weapon systems will malfunction and kill Ventari. It's that simple.
Yeah. All you have to do is line it up.
Right, exactly. And Sharon's like going, you know, Galen, he's just a kid. I can't do this. And Galen points out that, you know, back on Earth, Hitler and Genghis Khan were just boys playing with toys, slowly growing into monsters.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because nobody knew and nobody took the opportunity. But you do.
I don't know. It's like you have this. I wondered, how did that get set up? Was that just something Galen knew was going to happen? Did he have agents on Babylon 5 whisper in Lockley's ear?
My guess is that it was probably set up by the Technomages, you know, talking to ISN. Because
I mean, you know what? After reading the Technomage trilogy, Tim, I think you're spot on. I think, you know, because Galen does, he does say that, you know, those of our order who are pledged not to interfere and, you know you as a nexus, but he, you know, he talks about, he uses the pronoun we quite a bit,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Yeah, and I can see,
this
I mean.
The only way we can be sure.
And I can completely.
Sorry, go ahead.
Oh, I can completely see the Technomage just turning around and going, you know, it's a minimum amount of effort for me to just tell somebody that, just have somebody tell a reporter that this would make a good camera shot.
Mm-hmm.
You know, right, that requires nothing.
Or, you know, yeah, just sitting at a bar, you know where the guy is, and
right.
just start, you know, striking up a conversation,
yeah.
you know, and let him overhear it. It doesn't even have to be a direct approach.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I can totally see that. Could totally see that. So it's all set up.
Mm-hmm.
Sheridan has another dream, and this time he's dreaming of a space battle, and that was quite the space battle for all of 20 seconds. I mean, and I don't mean that in a bad way. I mean, it was, you know, swinging camera angles and ships firing and mm-hmm. things exploding and just one thing leading into another and... You know, there it is. The next morning, he's facing Ventari. You know, is it time to go? Yeah, how'd you know? And he says, how'd you like to ride fire alongside me in a Star Fury?
Yeah, and just really? See, you, like, the just, little 12-year, the buried 12-year-old goes, really? We get to ride on the roller coaster today?
Yeah.
Yeah, not knowing that, you know, somebody is going to pull the pin out of the roller coaster wheel base, and it's going to, you know. As soon as you come down the big hill, you're going to go crashing into the cotton candy stand.
Right.
And Sheridan, again, you could see he's still wrestling with it because he doesn't expect that response. You know, he doesn't really expect that. He's just the honest exuberance out of Ventari regarding this. And then, you know, they climb into the cockpit, and it's back and forth again. You know, I had a dream.
Right.
You know, I had a dream of riding into battle. The whole city's on fire. It's like, oh, man. Just when you think he's, you know, might get off free, the kid starts talking like that.
Yeah. It's almost like you that last little bit was geared to make it harder for Sheridan because you see the little too eager to get into a firefight. I was like, well, geez, now...
Yeah.
You know, is Galen right? Do I have to kill him? I can't do it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't want to do it. There has to be another way. And just flying along, happy as clams. You know, but Sheridan's happy to be back in the Star Fury. Prince Ventari.
Oh, it's like riding into battle, yeah, except for the part where they're shooting at you.
Yeah.
And then, like literally, Prince Ventari is out there like a little kid, you know, trying out a new bike.
Fun. Yeah.
And you see Sheridan just weighing the decision. He says, it's an accident, no problem.
Yeah.
You know, malfunction, couldn't see it coming. And he's like, damn it!
Talking to himself, right. Well, I would say to me, the weakest part of this story is it gets a little ham-fisted at that point with the, the flashback.
The flashback vision. With the original conversation, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. That, to me, was kind of really driving the point home. I thought that up to that point, it was, subtle but very apparent about the weight of the decision that Sheridan had. But yes, there are ways, and
right.
he decides to take the other way out, and.
Yeah, I think that really didn't show enough trust in your audience at that point.
Right. For some reason.
I can understand it because this could be used as a good way to introduce people to Babylon 5.
Right, but again, at that point, you said, you go through and you say, hey, look, if I was shown this to, say, my wife or something, she says, hey, why did he change his mind? And you go back and you say, look, he said there are ways.
Right.
So you go back to that scene and say, this is the quality of work you're dealing with, where he gives you the hint right up at the beginning.
Right.
So you pay attention to it and you enjoy it. And I just felt like I was being treated a little condescending by that scene.
Yeah, right. Mm-hmm. I agree with you. I don't know, what was driving that. So
yeah, I didn't feel condescended to. I did feel that it was a little long, though. Like
right.
the whole entire scene where he's making his decision and everything, I thought that went a little longer than necessary. But I don't think showing the flashbacks was heavy-handed.
Okay.
I don't. That's just my personal opinion.
Well, maybe it was just a combination then of the flashbacks and the length.
I don't know. But anyway, so Sheridan does make the decision. He cuts back on his speed. Ventari asks, is everything okay? And Sheridan says, no, I'm just enjoying the ride. And, Ventari's like, well, do you mind? Again, that 12-year-old.
Right.
You mind if I, pedal as hard as I can down the hill?
Oh, and take my training wheels off. Yeah.
Yeah, right. And that was great. I mean, that was, the unbridled exuberance that Ventari has on his face is zooming around the Star Fury. And I got to tell you what, that CG with the Star Furies was really spectacular. As the scene when they first are flying out and they do sort of the fly around of Sheridan and his Fury coming up from behind, I mean, it's seamless for one thing. But it just was really, I don't know, it's one of the best bits that they've done for Babylon 5. And yeah, I know the technology is better than it was, 10, 12, 15 years ago. But even still, that was just a really, really cool shot.
Well, and I was really impressed. I mean, even that scene seemed almost, it wasn't gratuitous, even though you can tell that they kind of went and just put the extra bit into the CGI. I mean, it was, in a lot of cases, it if you just look at that scene, it looks like CGI for CGI's sake. But because of the story, it fits with it. And I was really impressed with the entire disc, where they did not go through and throw too many of these gratuitous things in there.
Mm-hmm. I like how they cleaned up what did exist, though.
Right.
Yeah, that was very, very, very geeky for me to enjoy.
Yeah, to go back and go, hey, look, there's anti-aliasing now.
Yeah, there's that.
And then we land.
So they get back to this. They arrive on the station on Babylon 5, and Ventari comes running up to Sheridan. He's like, I haven't had fun like that since I don't know when. And Sheridan is very, withdrawn and contemplative. And again, here's another clue, of how Ventari might change. And he's honestly concerned for Sheridan. So, what's wrong? What's wrong? You look very thoughtful. Sheridan's reached out to him, and now he can find it with himself to reach out to somebody else. And
it was very poignant when he said, you see Prince Ventari with his look on his face, like, you know, yes, I understand you. You don't want to have anything to do with me now. He says, oh, no, on the contrary. He's like, what? Huh?
Right.
Yeah, right, right. Yeah.
And again, you
over,
start.
Why don't you come back and, you know, live on Minbar with our family? And Ventari says, well, you know, if I was cynical, I would think you're trying to get a foot in the royal court. And I'm thinking, if you were cynical, my God.
Well, yeah, and that's you know? Where you start seeing that kind of paranoid innocence coming in.
Right.
Again.
Right. But again, Sheridan says, you know what, if I was you, I'd think the same thing. Mm-hmm. And that is when, you know, Ventari really is just kind of...
He pays attention.
Yes.
You see it. You see the change because Sheridan says, well, I think that too, but how do you know I'm not? And he says, but wait, you're being honest about it, huh?
Yeah, right.
This is
yeah.
a new thing.
Well, and that, I mean, really at that point, I look at that as kind of a coming of age portion of this story. Where it really seems to be the first time that the prince has been treated as a man rather than this, you know, kid to be protected and, you know,
or,
that type
or
of thing.
Because treated as an individual as opposed to a title.
Or treated as an equal, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's right. almost like, you know, it's almost like your father sitting there going, okay, son, now you're a man type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm going to tell it to you straight.
Yeah. Yeah. And so we're kind of left there for further adventures with Ventaria, and then of course, you know, Colonel Lockley appears and shakes hands with President Sheridan, and I did think it was very nice for, you know, all us old time fans and newer fans, or, you know, Lockley says, this by you is hello. You know. And it was, you know, a big warm, genuine hug, and I think as much as it might have been the actors, I think it was also the characters too. And I, you know, that was really a really heartwarming scene. I really liked that. It didn't seem mawkish or too sentimental. It just seemed just right. And then we mirror the first scene where Galen appears after Sheridan sends Ventari and Lockley on their way. There's the tight close-up, and then Galen steps out. You know, it's like Sheridan's waiting for him at this point.
Right.
You know, that's what I liked about it. It wasn't a surprise. It's like he sent him on the way, you know, sent those two on their way, knowing that Galen was lurking around, and they needed to finish the conversation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we had an agreement. Yeah, we did.
He's like, yeah, we did. Your point.
Yeah.
Right.
The way he says this is almost like, you know, you've known me long enough. You know, the way Sheridan turns around and you know, says, yeah, so what? You know,
right,
it's like,
you've
known me long enough to know that it wasn't going to go your way.
Mm-hmm. And he actually tells him, he says, and I wonder if you didn't show me that in that way so that I'd come to this decision, because this is what you really wanted me to do. So you boxed me into a corner to make me make the decision that was opposite of what you said you wanted me to do. And Galen gets this little smirk on his face like, who, me?
Yeah, right. I love this little bit where, you know, where Sheridan tells Galen about Ventari's dream. You know, it's like, that was your work, wasn't it? And he's like, I get around.
You know, I wasn't keeping track this week. It could have been me.
That whole bit, do you actually think Galen boxed him into the corner to get to exactly that conclusion?
I think so.
Yeah.
Now, see, I'm looking at it a little bit differently. I think Galen is still mortal, and I think Galen's looking at it going, look, this is the only way out I can see is to kill him. Let's put Sheridan in a position.
No. The safest way out.
I would disagree. I think Galen. I think Galen is the representative of a group of technomages that is somehow either time traveling, and this is before, I mean, take the time travel out of it. I was watching it. Galen seemed to me, because of especially the use of the pronoun we, Galen was part of a group that is working to manipulate things. But I think Galen himself, as an individual, does not necessarily, you know, he's the one, from the technomage point of view, who is, okay, we need to stop Ventari.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody else says kill him because they're just technomages, and, you know, everybody else, you know, mere mortals are just pawns in our greater thing.
Right.
But Galen has more wisdom than that.
And I guess that kind of comes...
Yes, I think he boxed Sheridan in to get that result, because Galen personally doesn't want to have to kill if there is another way to do it.
And
Yeah, here's it. I think that Galen did it on purpose because he said later, he said, no, this is a way out, but killing him would have been the quickest
simpler,
and the easiest
right.
way to be sure. Because right. you don't know what's going to happen over the next 10, 15 years while he's living on Minbar.
Right.
You
Only
can't
with
be sure.
Can we be sure?
Right.
Right.
We can't. But, and there's really no certainty in that either.
Right. But what yeah. I took, I guess, what I kind of took from that was kind of Galen saying, you know, look, I kind of got the feeling that if Galen knew for certain there was another way, he would have told him. You know, so maybe there were five or six other ways that he thought were a little bit hazy. So why not throw it in the hands of the Nexus and let him choose because his choices seem to have been right so far. And then when he questions you on it, just make him, you know, just put things in a way that puts that mysticism back in.
Right. Well, as he tells Sheridan, you know, I'd say, Mr. President, that, you know, a mystery once unraveled no longer is as magic as it once was.
Exactly,
you know,
yeah.
Whatever the exact line is. But, yeah, that's the tone. You know, Tim, that's as valid an interpretation. I mean, I can thoroughly see where mm-hmm. you come to that conclusion.
Yeah, and the most obvious point is Galen's a technomage.
Right.
If he really, really, really believed that killing Prince Ventari would have been the solution, the mm-hmm. only solution,
would have done.
He and the other technomages could have taken care of that without involving Sheridan.
Absolutely.
Yeah, but they talk about, you know, those of the Order pledged not to interfere. Of course, that could be
well,
a whole different...
Well, he's interfering by involving Sheridan.
I know. That's exactly,
so,
that's exactly right.
I'm thinking he was telling the fib there.
It's a matter of degrees. I agree.
Right.
I agree.
No, absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah, so, it's when all is said and done, this installment is a great episode. I mean, it's a great Babylon 5 episode.
Mm-hmm.
The characters are fantastic. The interaction with the characters is fantastic. I mean,
mm-hmm.
those scenes with Box Lehner and Woodward really crackle with energy.
Yes.
They are just electric together. It is really, it's a joy to see. And, you know, again, without all the special effects, it's just the two guys in the room, and it's all driven by character.
Yeah, and the just how easily they both slip back into their roles is a testament to how well those characters were written.
Oh, yeah.
That they can pick them up like that, and you've seen that time has passed, and just everything that they had done in their real lives filters over in these characters, makes them, you know, enhance them a little bit more. And it's just, I have no other word for it. It's delicious to watch.
Yes, it is.
I would agree.
No, I think that works.
Right, and I think, you know, as I mentioned briefly in our interview with Keegan McIntosh, I am impressed with Keegan because he really, you know, I mean, I know it's acting and that's part of what they do, but he really held his own in those scenes with Box Lehner.
Oh, he sold it.
You know, you never got the sense that it was the young kid, up-and-coming actor getting a break, and, you know, he's working with this, you know, established guy.
Mm-hmm.
The characters came to life. He really brought Ventari to life, and you could really see, you know, you weren't sure which, you know, this kid could go either way. And that's what, you know, Sheridan's moral dilemma was how do you get him to the place where you want him to be as, you know, a kind, decent human being who has compassion for others, and, you know, but has come from an environment where there's none of that, where it's all, you know, you do things for other people just so that you can get them to do back for you. You know, it's all about manipulation.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the scene where, you know, he's talking about, Ventari saying, oh, you know, one day I'll come to the throne and we'll bring it back to glory days that haven't been seen since the early days of the Republic. And that's just the beginning,
right.
You know, and then, and it's those boyhood dreams of conquest. And, you know, and then immediately he goes to the, but you know what? So I'm very grateful for you opening up your place for me here on the ship where I know that I can rest in peace. I can sleep without having to worry about my throat getting slit.
Right.
and the ability to project that as an actor, that was just very impressive.
Oh, yeah. Well, no question at all.
Yeah. So, any last thoughts, or was that it?
I think that's about it. I mean, I know we've talked about a number of other, you know, issues that other, you know, callers and emailers have had about it, and we've dissected a fair amount of it. But so, and we'll continue to, because I know we've got more email and voicemail.
Oh yeah,
and right.
So forth. So.
So, with that, we will call this a show.
It's a show.
It's a show. I love this. I truly, truly believe that everyone who sees this will realize how magical Babylon 5 was, mm-hmm. and how much we deserve more. So, if you want to send in your own comments, you can send it, email them to babylonpodcast@gmail.com, or you can call us. That number is 206-338-2259. That's 206-338-2259.
The year New York still stood.
And we'll see you next time on the other side of the gate.